Last week, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere topped 400 parts per million for the first time in 50 years of direct measurements and probably for the first time in about 3 million years. Nowhere are the impacts of rising greenhouse gas levels more evident than in the Arctic. Temperatures in some parts of the Arctic have risen 4 degrees Celsius, sea ice is on the decline, and on land, the Arctic is becoming a greener place. Research published recently in the journal Nature Climate Change projects that rising temperatures will dramatically increase plant cover over the next few decades. By 2050, trees could be growing hundreds of miles north of the current tree line. Another new study released last week in the journal Science takes a look at the last time carbon dioxide levels were as high as they are today. That study paints a picture of an Arctic several degrees warmer than today and much wetter and greener. We'll talk with the lead author of that study in a few minutes. First, joining me here in our Woods Hole studios is Dr. Scott Goetz. He's the deputy director and senior scientist at Woods Hole Research Center, and he was the anchor author of the study Projecting the Future Greening of the Arctic. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Heather.
We also want to hear from you today. Does the prospect of a warm, green Arctic worry you? You can reach us by giving us a call at 866-999-4626. LivingLabRadio@WGBH.org is our email address, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Scott, the projections from your research released a few months ago were really quite, I think, surprising to a lot of people, just how dramatic and how rapidly the Arctic is getting greener. So just give us the lay of the land here. What are we looking at by 2050 in terms of how green the Arctic will be?
I think the results were surprising to us as well. We didn't expect the dramatic changes that we saw, and we looked at this a number of different ways under a range of climate scenarios and plant dispersal scenarios and using different methods, and every one of them showed really dramatic changes in the distribution of Arctic vegetation out to the 2050s. We don't put an exact year on it, but in the next 4 or 5 decades, we see dramatic changes, no matter what scenario we consider.
So how did the idea for this research come about? Is this something that came out of the theoretical idea that as the Arctic gets warmer, plant growth should increase? Or did this come out of some actual personal observations about what's currently happening in the Arctic?
I think we've known for a long time that changes have taken place in the Arctic historically with climate change, and vegetation, of course, responds to climate change. A lot of my work in recent decades, we have satellite records going back some 30 years now, over 30 years, and we see in the satellite record this greening trend. We can't necessarily say exactly which plants are responding, but we see quite significant changes in what we can measure from space, which is photosynthetic activity from satellite spectral bands, sensor bands.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about that. You are a satellite imaging guy, less time on the ground in the Arctic, more of it looking at it from this satellite perspective. Can you already see the Arctic getting greener?
Yes, we see that very clearly. Over the past 30 years, we see very dramatic changes, especially in the tundra areas. Low vegetation, heath and tussocks, and some shrub cover distributed across the Arctic. So we see that quite clearly in the satellite record. And then I do work in the field a bit and work with a lot of people who do, and we use that to calibrate what we see from the satellite observations.
Let's talk about the trees a little bit. I mean, you're talking about the fact that much of the Arctic, and I think this is really the image that most of us have in our mind when we think of the Arctic, is this tundra area, no really big plants, maybe just some small stuff, lots of lichen on rocks. But if you get a little bit further south in the Arctic, you are obviously in forested area. And the projection that forests could move over the course of just a few decades to me seems incredibly quick. Could we really be seeing full-size trees moving hundreds of miles in a matter of decades?
No, we don't see full-size trees. What we see is an increase in woody cover. So plants, shrubby plants with woody stems. And we also see trees moving in from areas further south, that transition zone. But it won't be, for our projections out to 2050, it won't be a dense, dark forest. It'll be, sparse scrawny trees like black spruce and larch distributed across the landscape. But we definitely see quite dramatic increases in the amount of those woody plants relative to the what we normally think of as tundra vegetation.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, you came to basically the same conclusion from a lot of different angles. Tell us a little bit about the actual data that you use to make these projections and how you go about working from that data to an actual projection for 4 decades from now.
What we did in this study was use an existing map. It's called the Circumpolar Arctic Vegetation Map, and it categorizes vegetation into different types, a range of different vegetation types. So we use that information to essentially define an envelope of environmental conditions in which each of those types is found. And then we project that. We first calibrate models to reproduce what we see currently. And we can do that very well, very robustly. Produce a map from a model that looks almost exactly like the current map of vegetation. And then we project that again into the future using a whole range of different climate scenarios, the IPCC fifth assessment report scenarios. And then we also looked at a whole range of different dispersal rates because it's quite difficult to know how rapidly dispersal will take place. But we know wind-blown seeds can travel great distances. Birds and other animals distribute seeds. So we look at those scenarios as well. And then we looked at a whole different set of models, these what we call now machine learning algorithms. They're sophisticated computational algorithms that have a lot of power, and they use a lot of data because we're dealing with a lot of data with the combination of all the climate data and a very large area at pretty high resolution, you know, 1 kilometer resolution over a very large area. So this type of modeling approach is really quite powerful because you can build these really robust algorithms. And so first reproduce exactly what it looks like today or at the time the current map was produced, and then run all these different scenarios into the future. And again, all of them show dramatic change.
So even the lowest estimates of warming, of increases in greenhouse gases, you still see a dramatic greening. But what's the range there in terms of what we might see? You know, dramatic could cover a lot of territory there. What's the range of possible predictions?
Well, the paper is very brief. The Nature Climate Change paper is, they're almost always just a few pages, but we have about 40 pages of supplemental material that explores all these different scenarios. And but it's pretty clear because even the low end of the IPCC climate change scenarios show significant warming. And it's clear from all of those that woody vegetation increases quite a lot. And that has pretty significant implications for climate, but also for people who live there and wildlife.
I want to bring Dr. Julie Brigham Gretty into the conversation. She's joining us now by phone. She's a professor of geology at UMass Amherst and the lead author of a new study that reconstructed the past climate of the Arctic. And that's in the distant past, about 3 million years ago, using a sediment core from an Arctic lake. Welcome, Julie.
Good morning, Heather and Scott.
You can join our conversation again by phone, 866-999-4626, or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. We want to know, does the prospect of a warm green Arctic worry you? Julie, your research is obviously a completely different avenue to look at climate change in the Arctic than what we've been talking with Scott here with satellites and future projections. You're using sediment cores to look into the distant past of the Arctic. And I mean, the timing of the release of this study couldn't be better. You're looking at the last time that carbon dioxide levels were around the 400 parts per million mark. We just passed that mark last week. What did the Arctic look like the last time carbon dioxide levels were this high?
Yes, it was a rather interesting coincidence. I wish I could claim that we'd planned that release of the paper that week. But what we're seeing in this very high northeast Russia location, just north of the Arctic Circle, about 100 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle, what we're seeing is the climate from about 3.6 million up to, at least in this paper, up to 2.2 million years ago. And what was quite surprising is in using the pollen-based reconstructions, again using modern analog techniques, and with a similar kind of approach that Scott was talking about, but then creating what is essentially a biomodel or an optimal reconstruction of what the ecosystems look like through time. What we see is that in the very earliest part of the record, we have very cool mixed forests around the lake at that time, and that these, over time, over the next million years or so, this forest eventually transitioned into tundra, but trees and forests persisted around the lake until at least 2.2 million years ago, particularly in what we call warm orbits, when the climate is optimized for warmer summers in the high Arctic. And so that we really didn't get the full-blown tundra environment to persist until much later into the early Pleistocene that we realized. So there's a lot of surprises. For example, there's Douglas fir and hemlock in around the lake at the time over 3 million years ago. So these are pretty exotic species for the Arctic.
So we're talking about a period of transition in your work 3 million years ago, which was going in the opposite direction of today. This was actually a period where carbon dioxide levels started around 400 parts per million, and it's actually getting cooler, as opposed to, you know, today, obviously, where carbon dioxide levels are going up and temperatures are going up.
Right. Many people don't realize that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been declining since 50, 60 million years ago. And with the weathering of rocks and the uplift of mountains, that actually consumes carbon dioxide. So over a series of steps over the last tens of millions of years, we've seen CO2 coming down. So at some point, carbon dioxide gets low enough that you can actually cool the Arctic enough to then start to initiate glaciation. And there's certainly a lot of different feedbacks involved in that whole process. So the reason that the Pliocene is thought to have had carbon dioxide levels similar to what we have today was because we were on this long decline. And, of course, over the last 3 million years, we declined to have normal values about 180 to 280 parts per mil over glacial-interglacial cycles. So as Scott mentioned, I mean, the rapid change in carbon dioxide is driving the system, the Earth system, into essentially like back into the Pliocene in many ways. And for this reason, the Pliocene and early Pleistocene are of interest to paleoclimate scientists like myself.
Now, when we look at this era, the Pliocene, 3.5 million years ago, the 400 parts per million, we knew that this was a warm period. What about your study changes our understanding of just how warm, wet, and green the Arctic was during this period?
Yeah, there have been a number of studies across different parts of the Arctic that provided what I call the Arctic borderlands around the Arctic Ocean, that provided glimpses of information, 10,000 years here or 40,000 years there, from different locations of slightly different age across the Arctic through this time period. So what our study does is we have found a site where the entire story is preserved in one place, and it's preserved in a way that's so continuous that we can actually evaluate the style and changes in the climatic cycles and the vegetation response and perhaps other ecosystem response directly over long time series. So we're able to take the spatial network of these other sites around the Arctic and then kind of plug them in to our more continuous record to really get an idea of the intensity of how warm were the summers, maybe some broad estimates of how cold were the winters, and really have a look at how these environments changed over time.
Well, you know, in your paper you say that your best estimates from this period are that that temperatures were probably 7 to 8 degrees warmer than they are today, that there were as much as hundreds of millimeters more rain in the Arctic than there is today. And in fact, you have a map in there that, you know, looks strikingly similar to some of the vegetation maps that that Scott had in his work. And yet you say that forests may have gone all the way to the shore of the Arctic Ocean at that point.
That's right. If you look across all of these sites, and in fact, I've truncated a map of the Arctic. I haven't shown given justice, really, to a lot of the records that are in the Russian Arctic, actually, other parts of the Russian Arctic. But all of these sites throughout the Yukon and the Canadian Arctic, even as high as northern Ellesmere Island, even a northern Ellesmere Island at a site that's dated to 3.2 million years ago, there's five different kinds of pine tree there. And these are not, this isn't just pollen, it's plant macrofossils and cones, and, you know, it's actually right there. So it gives you a very different impression of an Arctic where you've got, just imagine forests right up to the coastline, and it's very difficult to envision even much of a Greenland ice sheet at that time, that maybe there were some kind of glaciers hugging the mountains on the east coast of Greenland, but it's very different to, you can't even imagine perennial sea ice in it with forests that close to the Arctic. Our study is just contributing to the work of a lot of other scientists who have come to this conclusion that the Arctic was probably completely forested in the Pliocene.
So, Scott, I want to turn back to you and ask, you know, does this, talking about an Arctic at similar carbon dioxide levels to today that is several degrees warmer, that's wetter, that's very heavily forested, does that give you pause to think that perhaps even your most dramatic projections are actually perhaps conservative? And do we have any sense of why in the Pliocene the Arctic may have been even warmer and wetter than what we're seeing today at similar carbon dioxide levels?
I think I'll let Julie answer the latter question, but I guess it does point out just the fact that what she's seeing and her team are seeing historically is really quite consistent with what we're the trends that we're seeing from satellite data currently, and then the projections that we make. We see trees, shrubs moving right up, especially in the northeastern part of Siberia where this work was done, her work was done. We see very consistent results in terms of trees moving right up to the shore of the ocean there, the Chukchi Sea.
So Julie, do we have any sense of why there would be this difference between what the conditions are in the Arctic today and projected even into the future, maybe, you know, 2050 or so, and what you're talking about in terms of your best estimate for the Pliocene, where it was potentially much warmer and wetter?
Yeah, I think we have to remember that the Earth system, it's a sluggish beast, you know. It's got all these feedbacks in the ocean and the atmosphere and the land. And I think, you know, carbon dioxide is coming up so rapidly that the Earth is still responding to that increase and will continue to respond into the future. We've done some climate modeling here that has a interactive vegetation. And, again, there's lots of different varieties and flavors of climate models available to do this work. But when we put in 300 or 400, particularly 400 parts per mil, into our models, we see this very forested conditions that are consistent with our record. And this is talking about a climate that's been in equilibrium with those conditions over many thousands of years. Whereas, you know, today, we've only seen this warming in less than 100 years, so it is going to take the vegetation a while to respond to that. We already see other parts of the marine ecosystems heading northward, and I think it's too much to ask the vegetation to respond so quickly in less than 100 years. But given hundreds of years over the next, say, 1,000 years, we're going to be, I think, continuing to see the greening of the Arctic, perhaps consistent with what we see in the paleoclimate records.
Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. What's on your mind, Joel?
Hi. One factor I don't hear much mention of is the melting of the permafrost. My guess is that will be a mitigating factor, a slowing down of this whole process. Whereas most of the tundra is melting in units of centimeters and decimeters, there are apparently places where it is melted in terms of meters, and where some scrubby plants and trees have grown to actually start to look like trees. However, the solid permafrost beneath them has gone, so their roots are essentially just floating in water. And what we
all right, Joel, thank you. Thank you for your call. And if you have a question, you can also give us a call at 866-999-4626. Scott, perhaps you can weigh in on this, the role of melting permafrost, how that relates to plant cover. And I know there's also then a feedback that plant cover, changing plant cover, will then start to change the rate of warming of the ground as well.
That's right. Now, it's, Joel raises a question that I think just about everyone wants to know is, how rapidly will permafrost thaw, and how big is the implication of that in terms of it'll be an exacerbating effect. It won't be a mitigating effect. We're fairly certain of that, and all the experts agree on that. All the carbon, there's twice as much carbon stored in permafrost as there is in the atmosphere, at least twice as much. And when that comes out, as permafrost thaws, as we know is happening already, that will put a lot more carbon in the atmosphere. And that's what some people have referred to over the years as the carbon bomb. And that's something that we at the Woods Hole Research Center study quite a bit. We have teams that go into the field in the Arctic and Alaska, Canada, Russia, same area that Julie worked in, northeastern Siberia, and do coring and work with people who study permafrost. That's what everyone wants to know.
Well, so I mean, my understanding of what Joel was saying is essentially as the ground melts, it turns into mush. It might not actually be possible for melted permafrost to support trees or large woody shrubs. It would just be too mushy.
You do see that in some places, although it's quite variable across the landscape. It will certainly get wetter in some areas, other areas, and you see this with lakes. Sometimes you see lakes forming because there's so much melted ice and all the water in the landscape, and other times you see that drain away and lakes disappearing. So there's a whole dynamic with lakes and the wetness of the surface too.
Well, and as we see this changing in the plant cover, there's actually concern about how that will then feed back and potentially accelerate warming globally, because it changes the color and of the surface of the earth, but also the nature of the snow cover. Right, as you start getting these larger shrubby plants.
That's right. We see big effects of the, as you get a lot more woody vegetation, denser vegetation, it's darker, the reflectivity of the surface is lower. So essentially the vegetation is absorbing the sunlight and the heat, and that has that's also a positive feedback effect, meaning that it's going to make a warming environment even warmer. And so we've done, in fact, that was a big emphasis of our recent paper, is to show that albedo effect or reflectivity effect is really quite dramatic, and it drives the whole surface energy balance as well.
You know, I think that's so interesting because we typically think, oh, well, we need to stop cutting down trees and reforest. We hear a lot about trying to stop deforestation in the Amazon because those trees are our buffer against climate change. But when we go to the Arctic, getting more trees in the Arctic could actually accelerate warming. So it's just this very different situation, one that's not, I think, necessarily intuitive or the commonly heard version of things.
Right. It's a bit of a trade-off. These are generally not big trees that are taking a tremendous amount of carbon out of the atmosphere. They tend to be in these environments. Much smaller trees, they do have a net carbon uptake in terms of being productive, but relative to a tropical rainforest, it's small.
Julie, there's obviously a lot of concern right now about modern climate change. As someone who studies climate change on the scale of millions of years and has this very firm grasp on the constantly changing climate of our planet, I wonder how personally concerned you are about current climate change, and how much you think we can what are the lessons that we can take from past climate change to apply to our current situation?
Well, I think that you know, a lot of the evidence that people like Scott and myself and many others who study the dynamics of the Earth's system on different timescales, I think everyone would agree that we have to expect that if we continue to increase the carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that we are sending ourselves in a direction that's going to be very, very difficult to come back from. And while we might be able to adapt in some ways, I mean, my biggest concern is really with the sea level rise that will be driven by this warming. And sea level rise is going to be very difficult to turn around. And so that's really my concern, is that I think the sooner we do something rather than just continue to talk about it, the faster we'll be on a road to actually trying to slow down the process and hopefully try to slow down the process of continuing to melt the large ice sheets and glaciers. So I have to remain optimistic that we'll be able to do this, although I certainly feel like the train left the station a long time ago. We really think about, if we really could have thought about this in 1970, 72, when we started Earth Day and the Clean Air Act and all of that, if we knew then what we knew now, I think we would have been on a different track.
Scott, we have just a few seconds before we go, but how much does this concern you?
It concerns me a great deal. I think these papers and the recent threshold of 400 parts per million should wake everyone up. I think glaciers are actually moving at a faster pace than some of the policy in climate these days. So I think we really need to take notice of this and move forward and put in place policies that need to be put in place.
Dr. Scott Goetz, the Deputy Director and Senior Scientist at Woods Hole Research Center, Dr. Julie Brigham-Gretty, a Professor of Geology at UMass Amherst, thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
You can find links to both of the studies we discussed today on our website, capeandislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the program menu. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. Living Lab is on Facebook and Twitter all week at Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.